The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
For those of you who were not here last week, the topic was the five hindrances, and I thought I would continue on that topic today. Sometimes it's nice to stay on a topic for more than 1 week. It's a way of letting it sink in more, let us reflect more on it. Our tradition of meditation puts a lot of emphasis on overcoming the five hindrances. These are five forces which of the mind which make it very difficult, can make it difficult to be present, to be concentrated, to be focused. And it's said to be a hindrance to being wise. When these are present, people tend not to act wisely or think wisely. And because they are a hindrance to concentration, to getting focused, they are very important to overcome for the development of meditation, where the point of meditation is to somehow be focused and present here and not have the mind wander off and be distracted. In fact, the tradition, the Buddhist tradition, picks out these five as the primary hindrances that hinder or get in the way of being really focused and present. Whether that's really the case for all of us here, I don't know if that's the primary hindrances, but the tradition calls this the primary. And so these five are, in the mindfulness tradition, the first one is usually called sensual desire. In the discourses of the Buddha, sometimes the first one is called covetousness, which is maybe broader than sensual desire. It's any kind of preoccupation with wanting to get things and have things. The second one is ill will, sometimes translated into English as aversion. The third is translated into Victorian English, and that somehow is stuck as sloth and torpor. And the fourth is usually sometimes translated as restlessness and regret, sometimes as anxiousness and regret or remorse. And the fifth one is doubt. And the imagery that the tradition has for these gives some sense of how significant these are as hindrances for the mind. It's said that sensual desire, the image given is that of like a lake or a pond. And so the sensual desire is as if the clarity of the pond is obscured because someone has put a dye into it, like a red dye. So when you're in the throes of sensual desire, we tend to put on certain kind of rose-colored glasses. We tend to see the world through the filter of the desire, what we want, and sometimes we don't see clearly. And so, so like a lake that's filled with dye. For ill will, the ancient analogy is the lake's boiling, so hot that's boiling and bubbling. So you can't see clearly because of it. Just, you know, the mind is boiling over. And the sloth and torpor is as if the lake has been thoroughly covered and saturated with algae. So if you try to make your way through, swim through a lake that's completely filled with algae, it's kind of like yucky and slow and, you know. And then restlessness is like a strong wind is whipping up the surface of the lake, stirring it up. So again, you can't see clearly because the surface is all agitated. And doubt is as if the pond is filled with mud. It's kind of saturated with mud. And so, again, it's kind of like heavy and sticky, and you can't see into the bottom again. There's no clarity. And again, if you try to swim through it or walk through it, maybe because of all the heavy mud, it kind of like really, you know, it's really hard work. So the mind has these qualities. Sometimes the mind has these, sees through things through its colored glasses. Sometimes the mind boils over. Sometimes the mind is swamp mind. Sometimes sloth and torpor. It's just like, you know, you can't get through it. It's heavy, tired. And sometimes the mind is really agitated. Can't hardly see anything but the surface, you know, stirred up. And sometimes the mind is like mud. So just really, you know, can't make a decision, can't go forward, can't go backwards. It's supposed to be, I think, the analogy for mud, for doubt. Sometimes there's other analogies in the ancient world for these mind states. I don't know if I can get this one right exactly, but how it goes. But some I won't try. But some of them are as if we're enslaved, as if we're imprisoned, as if we're doubt is as if you're lost in a barren desert, and as if we're sick. Sick, enslaved, in prison, in the barren desert, and I forget the fifth one.
Dead.
What?
Dead?
In debt. Oh, in debt. Yes, thank you. In debt. So, and these analogies are have a secondary point, and that is, if you have any of these conditions and you're finally free of it, chances are you'll feel happy. You'll be delighted, or you know, you'll by that condition. So, if some of you, if you've been sick for a while, or had a headache for a while, or you know, just been a drag, and then it's gone, it's like feels so good to be well again. Or if you're, some of you maybe have been weighed down by debt. I hope you're out of debt. And so that feels good. No longer have that burden of debt. Or I don't know how many of you have been in prison, but if some of you have been in prison, it probably feels pretty good when you get out. I know I've been in visited prisons without having gotten a sentence. I've gone a number of times now to San Quentin to visit the meditation programs that are being taught at San Quentin. And it's quite something to go into San Quentin. And it's quite something to get out. You know, it's kind of, there's a kind of gratitude and clarity and poignancy. And life is very poignant after you've been to San Quentin. Boy, I recommend everyone should go there. It's quite an experience. And I don't know, people usually don't get enslaved so much anymore, but it does happen some places. And so it probably feels pretty good not to have that. And this idea that it's supposed to feel good, you feel happy by the relief from them, is part of the benefit of overcoming these five hindrances. And that feeling of happiness is meant to be a foundation, a support for getting concentrated, support for really being interested or focused on being present here in a good way. And so it's possible to go through the mind when you sit in meditation and kind of do a inventory, and ask yourself, are you in the grips right now? Are you caught up in sensual desire? Are you thinking about what you want to have, and whatever sensual desire, whatever covetousness you might have? Are you caught up in that? And if the answer is no, that's kind of nice, especially if you've had a history of having the mind caught up in that. And then you check the next one. Is there ill will operating here now? Is there aversion? Are you caught up in some kind of resentment? And you say, no, there isn't any. And then you say, is there sloth and torpor? Is the mind tired or sloggy? And then you say, no, the mind feels pretty clear and energetic. And then you can do the next one. Is there restlessness? Is there remorse or regret? And you say, no, it's just here in a nice way, and there's no sense of being regret, or no sense of defensiveness, or feeling bad about oneself, just kind of here in a clear way. And then, is there any doubt or uncertainty or vacillation going on? No, I know I'm here, I'm present, I'm focused, I'm engaged. And to go through that inventory sometimes does two things. One is that it's focusing, which is part of the purpose of meditation, is to get focused here, that the mind gets settled and focused. But also, it's a way of bringing a heightened sense of appreciation for the fact that the mind is not caught up in these things. If you have ever sat down to meditate and had your mind caught up with these kinds of things, some of them are immediately a drag, and some of them become a drag. The one that becomes a drag is sensual desire. Especially like on meditation retreats, people can have, because you're kind of one of the things about being on a retreat, you have all day to fantasize. You know, you're not being interrupted a lot because you don't have to go to work, you don't have to answer emails, you don't have to talk to anyone, so you're just left, you know, to your mind. And so people can fantasize for a long time. I once had the same fantasy for 3 days. It was a 3-month retreat, so kind of amazing, right? And it was kind of, you know, I don't know, maybe it was a kind of desire fantasy. That's what the hook was, perhaps. But it was designing helicopters. And I had a whole business plan developed, and I don't know anything about aviation or aerodynamics or engineering or anything, but that didn't stop my mind. What happens on long retreats like that is the mind gets very concentrated, and sometimes that concentration, rather than staying focused on the breath, like a good mind does, supposed to, it will get focused on some thought, some idea, and you can't get it off that idea. So I spent three days this way. So, so it was a relief to stop, you know, like no longer to have that. There's like sexual fantasies people have, or vacation fantasies or something, and they can be pleasant at first, and delightful, and that's part of the desire, part of the hook that keeps us engaged in them, the promise, the enjoyment, the great entertainment value of our fantasies. But a remarkable thing happens if you do this day after day or hour after hour. Sooner or later, it starts becoming a drag, and the mind gets really tired of it. And you can start feeling the deleterious effect it has to have this going on and on. And so then you kind of, please stop. And you would think that, kindly saying to the mind, please stop, or saying no, your mind would listen to you. I mean, who's in charge after all, right? You know, you're supposed to be in charge, and you tell the mind to stop, and that should be the last of it, right? No, because we're enslaved, we're in prison, we're lost in a barren desert. We're not so much in charge, and so it can feel kind of, then it's a drag. You can feel, if there's aversion going for a long time, that feels like a drag much quicker, or sloth and torpor, or these things, the agitation. And so it can feel like a relief when finally that lets up, and the mind is settled and focused and clear. And so the tradition says that there's a kind of joy or delight that can come when the mind is no longer in the grip of the hindrances, and that it's useful to avail yourself of that delight, to allow yourself that delight, because that delight makes it more interesting to be present. Makes, you know, that's a kind of a hook. It kind of makes it interesting to be focused and present, and becomes a foundation for further concentration, for further presence here. So the so when the hindrances go away, there's delight. When the hindrances go away, there's the mind can see more clearly. That's why it's possible to be wise, have more wisdom. And when the hindrances go away, the tradition then says the opposite qualities can begin to arise and develop. And these opposite qualities are it's what's paired with or connected with is what's called the 7 factors of awakening. And these are beautiful states of mind that have a chance to flower, blossom in our minds when the hindrances are no longer operating. And these are mindfulness, investigation, effort, joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. And these are considered the crown jewels of Buddhist practice, these 7. And some of them might not seem so appealing right away, like investigation. What's that about? That seems like work. But in fact, it's quite a beautiful state when it becomes strong and very present. So these have a chance to surface when the hindrances are not caught in the grip of those hindrances. So the hindrances operate in meditation, and part of what we try to do in meditation is to overcome those hindering qualities. They can also operate in daily life. In meditation, chances are you're not going to make too many big mistakes when the hindrances are there because you're committed to sitting still. You know, you're not supposed to move, really. So if you covet the person next to you in the meditation hall, you could think of fantasies about her or him, but, you know, you're not supposed to move. It's a little embarrassing, you know. Everyone's quiet, so you shouldn't do anything. So you're safe here, right? But if you're out in the world, you know, you might not be so, you know, who knows how safe you are out there. So in the world, we can make mistakes. We can do things later that we regret. And so in the world, sometimes these hindrances can operate much more strongly. And so it becomes even more important to have a handle on how to work with them, how to identify them, and how not to let them have the upper hand. So when we're in the grip of desire, that we can recognize the desire and have an ability not to get swept up in it, to step back and not make, have ill will or aversion or hostility or anger, to recognize it, see it clearly, and have the ability not to be swept away by it, not be hindered by it or caught by it, enslaved by it. So same with all the five hindrances. And so by learning to identify and work with the hindrances in meditation, it becomes a great support for how not to have these things control us and run us in daily life as well. So we say in our meditation tradition that it's very useful when these hindrances arise in meditation to investigate them, to get to know them, to explore them. And so it's helpful to not take them as personal failings. You're the only person who's ever had a hindrance, but rather take them as part of the human condition. It's kind of and when it's your turn to have it, say, "Great, this is good. Now I get to look at it. I get to try to understand it better." And so, this idea of investigating and being curious and looking more deeply into our condition is one of the hallmarks of this mindfulness tradition. Rather than making things a problem, even the hindrances, which are kind of a problem, we don't treat them as a problem. We treat them as something to investigate and look at, to understand. So there's a kind of turning towards them and say, "What is this? Let me." And as soon as you investigate, as soon as you look towards it, you're changing the ecology of your mind, because you're kind of beginning to take charge. You're in charge, and you're saying, "I'm going to look at this more carefully," as opposed to the hindrance being in charge and pulling you off into fantasy and thinking and even action in the world itself. And it's kind of like if you bring a new species into an ecosystem, the whole ecosystem changes. If you bring very clear sense of investigation, "Let me look at this," the inner ecology of your mind begins to change and moves towards increased mental health to do that. So we try to look at it and investigate it. So part of it then is to learn how it is. What is a hindrance? How does it operate physically? How does it operate emotionally? How does it operate cognitively with thoughts and beliefs? And how does it operate with intention? What kind of intentions or motivations are present for us when these hindrances are here? And to go through these kinds of, like, those four things and feel the physical effect of having hindrance on us, to feel the emotional effect, to feel the cognitive effect on the mind, and to feel the intentional volition, the effect on a volition, motivation, is an interesting thing to do. One of the things that happens with that kind of investigation is it becomes clear what the cost is for having the hindrance. You can feel that it's a drag. You can feel the tension, the stress that's involved in it. You can feel the way it weighs it down. You can feel that the way in which we get hooked by it or create a certain kind of belief system, that we believe it, we grant it authority, we're fighting with it, we give into it. You can kind of see what's going on in some way. And as we begin seeing better and better how all this works, then it's kind of like a magician's magic trick. You can watch a magic trick for a long, long time and be fascinated until the magician shows you how the trick is done. And once you've seen how the trick is done, then, you know, then it's not so interesting pretty quickly. You get bored, you know, okay, that's enough. So once you see how the trick of the mind, it's easier to, you know, the mind's not going to be pulled in so much. Enough of that. But often we don't see how the trick is done when we have strong desire. It's just the promise is so great that, of course, it's, you know, that we're mesmerized by it. when we see that this is, you know, how it all works, then it's, you know, it's more or less likely to be pulled into it. And so that takes investigation. And I would like to, I'd like to suggest that there's no magic trick, that, you know, your magic button, just push the button and you'll never have a hindrance again. And you're looking for that button. Rather, what it is, it's a very maturing process of getting to know yourself, investigating, finding out, being curious, self-discovery. That's where this, you know, how we learn to see through the trick. So in the mindfulness tradition, the focus is a lot on turning around being mindful of these states. If the intensity of the hindrance is mild, then sometimes just turning around and looking at it and seeing and recognizing it's there is enough to have it kind of lose its force and it fades away. But there are times when the hindrances are much stronger than that, and we get pulled into it and we can't let go of it. Even if you're mindful of it and see it, you still keep slipping into it. It's quite strong. And sometimes other things are needed besides mindfulness. And so the tradition gives a toolbox of tools of how to practice with the hindrances. And there are different tools that can be useful at different times. So I'd like to offer some of them to you. Perhaps you'll find them interesting. So one is to be mindful of it. And part of being mindful is to investigate it more carefully. Another interesting tool is to ignore it. Because sometimes by ignoring it, we stop feeding it. So sometimes that can be actually be a wise ignoring of a strong desire or strong ill will, and just kind of focus on something very different, and develop and try to have a focus on this other thing so strong that you're not pulled into the world of the hindrance of desire, or aversion, or doubt, or whatever it might be. And so sometimes people will choose something very interesting or fascinating or compelling to focus on in order to kind of get the mind off. So for someone who's maybe done a lot of breath meditation, it can be just, I'm going to be concentrated on the breath. In meditation, some people find loving kindness meditation compelling or compassion meditation compelling because it shifts. You know, that can be more interesting than just the breath, because the breath is boring after all, some people think. And so if it's boring, the mind will go into the hindrance. So to find something else to do, especially for desire or for aversion, would be to contemplate death. Wouldn't that be nice? So, you know, I'm going to die soon enough. You know, you're sitting there and you're fantasizing about your favorite sexual partner that you've ever dreamed of, and you can't get it off it, and then you start thinking, but death, he's going to die, she's going to die, I'm going to die, and what the corpse is going to look like, and what would it be like to be kind of intimate with that corpse. You know, that changes kind of like the inner landscape. And so so to focus on something different, right? So maybe that's not so different, but... but but to ignore it, to say it a different way, this ignoring part, there's one very powerful and significant way to overcome a hindrance is to cultivate a strong, concentrated mind. So rather than developing mindfulness of the hindrance and looking at it and being present that way, kind of ignore it and then focus on some object like the breath and really focus to get strong, get concentrated, which means to... keep working on it until the mind's strength of concentration is stronger than the strength of the hindrance. And it might take a lot of effort and work to really develop that. In Asia, there's a lot of stories of meditators who use concentration to overcome a variety of different hindrances. One of the favorite ones I read in these biographies of Thai meditation masters is they'll go sit in charnel grounds. They have these grounds where they burn the bodies. And they go sit there through the night meditating. And in Thailand, there seems to be, or at least people say there are, ghosts and goblins that come to charnel grounds. So it's a scary place to be. And so these stories of these meditators would go sit there, and sure enough, they'd start hearing some kind of footsteps in the middle of the night, something dangerous, or the tigers would come. And so instead of running away or getting afraid or opening their eyes, they would just really focus on their breath, really get concentrated. And that would be their way of dealing with it. And the ones who lived to tell, inevitably say how great that worked. So the idea of, you know, really focusing, the problem with really using really strong concentration to overcome a hindrance, sometimes it occasionally it can backfire because we don't learn anything about the hindrance in that process. We're kind of like sidestepping it. And so it's there kind of waiting in the background, waiting for when your concentration lessens to come back in full force. But it can work also in a different way, because as the mind gets concentrated and strongly concentrated, the mind also gets filled with joy, with rapture, with a certain kind of happiness. And so the strong sense of happiness that comes in meditation becomes an alternative to the allure of happiness or joy or pleasure that can come with the sensual desire. And in fact, the Buddha said, if you really want to overcome the lure or the temptation or the addiction to sensual desire, one of the most effective ways is to develop strong concentration, because the joy there is so much better, so much more holistic or whole or satisfying than any pleasure you can get from sensuality. And so if you know there's something better, it's easier to let go of the joy of sensual pleasure. And that's kind of interesting, because it's not rejecting sensual pleasure as bad. It's just saying there's something better in town. And so when your mind really knows that, then that kind of addiction to sensual pleasure begins to lessen. So this is one of the results of concentration, is to provide you with that a contrast, so that it becomes less interesting to go this kind of lesser pleasure. And for me, I've seen this a lot, that coming out of meditation and feeling a certain level of joy or happiness, that joy and happiness persists for some time. And as it persists, there's a lot of things which I kind of might be lean towards or want to have or feel dissatisfaction about not having. It doesn't really operate, because I have this deep sense of satisfaction from the concentrated state that I was in. And so I can leave things alone much more. I'm not that interesting. I'm already saturated. Why would I want more? And I'm saturated by something that didn't require anything of the world. It's kind of like didn't cost anything, except sitting there and getting concentrated. So ignoring by getting concentrated, or ignoring by focusing on something else, is useful. The other thing that tool that the tradition sometimes offers is using an antidote. So an antidote would be something that's the opposite, that kind of neutralizes the hindrance that's there. And so the antidote that the tradition gives for sensual desires, what I mentioned earlier, is kind of like thinking about corpses or thinking about the foul, the tradition, or the English people sometimes translate it as the foul aspects of the body. The actual word in Buddhist language doesn't mean foul, it means the non-beautiful. So if you can think of, maybe, you know, if you're such a person who can think about non-beautiful parts of human bodies, parts of the human bodies you wouldn't actually want to sit there and stare at, and, you know, for a while, then you know, kind of contemplate the foul aspects of the body. If, not because they're, you know, like the body's bad, but if you're so strongly in the grip of sensual desire, I think what they imply here is sexual desire, since it's the fouled body, right? If you're so in the grip of it, And people are. It's remarkable how many people either their partner or they themselves come and talk to me about addiction to pornography. In the 1990s, when I first was a teacher, I don't think anybody talked to me about it. But it seems like in the last 5 years, people are talking to me regularly, and it might have something to do with the web and how easy it is. But, you know, so this is a problem. You know, so that pornography thing is part of the sensual desire. And I've heard people who have really damaged themselves through this kind of issue. So it's an issue. So if it's really addictive and really a problem, you need strong medicine. So, contemplate the foul aspects of the body. You know, maybe that, you know, that would help, kind of like the mind kind of thing. Or look at pictures of corpses. Or go to an anatomy lab and you know, look at the corpse in anatomy lab. There's a Buddhist teacher in Santa Cruz who likes to bring his students to the anatomy lab, the local college. And I'm going to try to bring some people there down there in the summer. It's interesting to go see corpses, and especially anatomy labs, because they're cut up in interesting ways. And so you get to, you know, look at them. And I went, the first time I went, I was in to an anatomy lab. I was a freshman in college. I was taking a drawing class. And the teacher said that they took the students every year to an anatomy lab because after going to the lab, their drawings are much stronger. And so we went twice for 3 hours to draw this corpse. And the first day, I drew the foot because I figured the foot was as far as away from facing death as I could possibly get. And then I realized how I was kind of trying to ignore, so then the next day I went back, I drew the face. I thought that would facing it directly. But the remarkable thing about the anatomy lab, the first visit, was the anatomist, I don't know, the person there, said, well, what part of the body would you like to see? Well, the body was laying there naked. I mean, you could see everything, I thought. What part would you like to see? I didn't know what, I couldn't understand what was being meant. And it turned out that the whole body was dissected and just put back together like a puzzle. And you could just like take this skin off and this thing off and this thing off, you know, down to the bone. So you do that, and then then you go home and try to think about her. You know, your sexual fantasy, and you know, it's kind of, you might kind of have second thoughts. So that's not like saying like the body is terrible or sexuality is terrible. It's just like if you have a big problem, bring out the big medicine. And this is the big medicine, you know. And maybe that'll help. We used to have here somewhere in the building, in our corpse, but we had, I haven't found it for a while. We used to have these big 8x11 photographs of burnt, charred corpses. And it's quite graphic. So, if any of you have any big problem that you need help with, with addiction or sex or something, I'll look for them for you. You can paste them next to your computer monitor. So that's the antidote for sensual desire. The antidote for ill will, anger, aversion, is loving kindness. So to cultivate a heart, a mind of goodwill, of friendliness. And it's quite remarkable that this Buddhist tradition has a whole technology, a whole series of practices to cultivate and develop our capacity for goodwill, open-heartedness, warm-heartedness. And it doesn't have to be by chance that we feel love for people. We can cultivate and develop it. And that's an antidote. They say that the antidote for sloth and torpor is light. And so sometimes either visualizing light, white light or yellow light, or sitting in such a place with your eyes open or sitting in a place where even with your eyes closed, there's a lot of light coming in, sometimes can awaken or brighten up the mind, clarify the mind. So it helps a little bit. restlessness and agitation, it's usually concentration practice that calms it down or settles it. And for doubt, I don't know what the antidote for doubt is. Doubt is probably faith, to cultivate faith. And so to cultivate faith in any kind of faith that supports you in the practice or supports you kind of not to be doubt, to have doubt. So cultivate your confidence in the practice, your confidence in the teaching, confidence in the path you're on, confidence in yourself, confidence in your teachers or other people, practitioners you know. Something that kind of brightens the mind or settles the mind or encourages the mind, gives it confidence to overcome the doubt. So sometimes we actively then kind of consider these antidotes. The problem with using antidotes sometimes is that sometimes that's a way of ignoring the problem, so we don't understand it well. And sometimes the antidotes are used as kind of a cover over what's going on. And so it's kind of like a pretend almost. It doesn't really neutralize or settle the underlying condition. It just kind of covers it over for the time being. So that's why I think that one of the really useful things is to, sooner or later, to try to come back to mindfulness, to come back and turn around and really look deeply at what's going on. And as I said last week, especially with the first two hindrances, desire and aversion, each of those tend to have an object, the things we're desiring or things we have aversion towards. So the mind is usually focusing at the object. And if you can turn the mind, the attention 180 degrees around, away from the object, to what it's like for you to have desire, have aversion, then you see actually a subjective experience in a deeper way and investigate that. And that disconnects you from the object. It doesn't disconnect, it doesn't deny the fact you're having it, but it turns you towards the actual experience of having it. And when you feel the actual experience of it and explore it, that's where wisdom can start to be cultivated and developed. So to come back to mindfulness, So two things about that, and then I'll stop. So with mindfulness, we understand what's going on better. Understand, it's easier to become free of something if we understand it. And as we keep cultivating mindfulness, we are also then strengthening the mind. The muscle of mindfulness gets stronger and stronger. And so the ability to have the mind be stronger than the hindrance, the mindfulness be stronger than the distracted mind, becomes stronger and stronger. And so at some point it's so strong, the mind, or the mindfulness is, that a hindrance might arise, desire or aversion might arise, but you're simply not going to go there because this mind is so strong. It's just going to stay focused and stay present here and not get hooked into those kinds of thoughts. And to have a strong mind is a great thing. To paraphrase or to misquote a Buddhist quote, a strong mind is a happy mind. The actual quote is more like a tamed mind is a happy mind. So you can either one. So that's my thoughts for today. And the hindrances. People who do mindfulness practice are meant to become hindrance experts. And not by doing them really well, but by when they do arise, to investigate them, get to know them, and start getting the upper hand so they no longer hinder. So, and in that process, when they no longer hinder, I hope that you take time to appreciate and enjoy the state of the mind that's not caught up in the hindrances. Avail yourself of that joy, that happiness, that relief. Okay? Thank you.